Christina Bryan Fitzgibbons, a genetic and family investigator.
And I'm Jody Klugman-Rabb, a licensed marriage and family therapist and licensed professional clinical counselor. Welcome to Sex, Lies, and the Truth. This is a story that will stay with you a while. It will linger in your memory the way only a good story can, when told with love and loss, aching of things unrealized but understood. You will hear the tragedy of a mother-daughter bond gone wrong, but the redemption of another bond brought on by a synchronistic Christmas present. We can't wait for you to meet Allie.
So my name's Allie Brumwell. I live in Vancouver, BC, Canada, and I have my entire life. I grew up in a family of three older brothers and my parents. My dad was a police officer and my mom was a stay-home mom. And growing up, I always felt that I fit in and that I looked like my brothers and that, you know, we all had brown hair and blue eyes. And I wasn't like other kids who questioned their parents about, oh, are you sure I'm not really your child, or, you know, I'm adopted, or I never ever had those inclinations at all. And I remember having kids in my class in elementary school that were adopted and feeling sad for them. Like, I had this perception that they were given away and that they were unwanted. And so that was sort of like some weird belief I had as a child. And I never questioned my own identity. When I was almost 18, 4 days or 10 days before my 18th birthday, my mom called me downstairs because she wanted to have a talk with me because I'd been spending a lot of time with my boyfriend late at night and she couldn't possibly imagine what I'd be doing. And she always was hung up about sex my entire life. I was the only girl in the family. I had to stay very covered up. There was a lot of shame around it. And I really imagined that something terrible had happened to my mom when she was a teenager, something that she'd never revealed because she had some huge issues. So anyway, she sat me down and she said, I want to know, I have a question for you. I want to know, are you on the pill? And I thought, whoa, okay, well, I've been with my boyfriend for 3 years, recently just started the pill to be responsible. And I thought I could lie or I could tell the truth. So I got up all my courage and I said, yes, I am. I'm on the pill. And she lost it. She lost it on me. She went up one down side of me, down the other, saying all sorts of terrible things, accusing me of using my parents and spitting in their face because I knew how they felt about premarital sex. This was 1984. So anyway, it was just this huge ordeal of shame and, you know, made me question whether I should have said anything. And then all of a sudden she started shaking and crying hysterically. And she was a smoker and she was walking around the kitchen, puffing furiously on her cigarette. And then she started saying, if I had been a better mother, I would have told you this sooner. And I thought, oh, this is it. This is the story of sexual abuse or trauma or something. This is why she's hung up. If I had been a better mother. And I said, Mom, I know what you're going to tell me. And she just turned white. She went, oh my God, you probably do. What? And I said, no, just tell me. Just tell me what you're going to say. And she looked at me and she said, you're not our child. You are a mistake.
So clearly that is the wrong thing to say, and obviously the result of having put absolutely no thought into how this conversation would go, despite having 18 years to prepare for it. These conversations are hard, impossible to fathom, really, but practicing all the ways it could go wrong and the few ways you could get it right means hurtful things like this are less likely to happen.
I felt like I'd been hit over the head with a baseball bat. And I had an out-of-body experience. It's like she knocked me so far out of my body. I was like up in the corner of the room watching. And I could see us sitting at the table. And I said, I was like so spaced out. And I said, are you telling me a story? She said, no, I'm not telling you a story. You're adopted. You're not our child. We wanted a girl. We had three boys. So we adopted a girl. I'm like, well, do the boys know about this? Meaning my brothers. And she said, yes, the boys know about this. And I said, well, does grandma know about this? She said, yes, grandma knows about this. And I said, well, do the neighbors know about this? And she said, yes, the neighbors know about this. And that's when I came back into my body and it just hit me. I felt like I had a huge hole blown out of the center of my chest. It was just really a bizarre, surreal experience. And she gave me about 15 minutes to process it. And then she was back on me about being on the pill. So it was really traumatic. And she threatened that my dad would no longer want to support me because of what I'd done to them. And I just had this incredible sense of shame. And of course, my dad was an amazing man. And he said, told my mom to shut up. Of course, he was going to support me. I went to bed that night just thinking, I had no idea about any of this. And everything I thought I was, I wasn't. Yet I was the same person standing in the same body, in the same house, in my same room. But everything had been pushed sideways, like I was standing outside of my body. And the next morning I woke up and I felt like I was a guest in my own house. I walked down the stairs and I felt like everything belonged here but me. And I needed permission to be there. And I said to my mom, is it okay if I have some cereal? Like, I felt like I had to ask permission. And she was like, what are you talking about? Of course you can. And she just didn't give me any space to process any of it.
For the better part of the next year, Allie processed this revelation when mom again offered information out of nowhere. Allie learned her birth parents had been dating in high school when they got pregnant. Using the same bluntness Allie's mom is famous for, she again told her daughter what she knew. She couldn't keep you, or didn't want to keep you, so she gave you up. Perhaps realizing her error, Allie's mom added hastily how much she and Allie's dad had wanted a girl, and added more details of the adoption.
They really wanted a girl, and it was easy to adopt in 1965, which was when I was born. But that I was born in July and the social worker was on holiday, so I actually didn't come to them for 2 months. I was in foster care for 2 months. So that was another missing piece. But in that next year, I started to fantasize about who my birth mom was. Like, oh, she'd be younger than my parents, and I wonder if she still thought about me or where she lived or if she even knew where I was or whatever. I started having all these fantasies, and every middle-aged woman that I saw, I thought, I wonder. And then all of a sudden I thought, maybe my mom, who I grew up with, who I call my mom, is thinking about who her real daughter would have been if she could have had a daughter. And I just shut down. I shut down any thoughts that I deserved anything better than what I had. I shut down any fantasies of ever meeting my family or having a connection because I didn't feel like I deserved it. So it was pretty rough. And luckily I had some people in my life who had a different take on it, who said, wow, I think that's really exciting. Like, you actually have a whole other part of you that you're yet to discover. And I don't think this is a loss at all. I think this is an opening and a new path. And so I decided to join Parent Finders, which was a nonprofit that reunited or gave information to adoptees and birth families, because it was all closed. There was nothing open at that time. And so I joined Parent Finders and put it out of the back of my head.
Allie learned there was a way to get information on child welfare records, so she wrote to Vital Statistics in Victoria, the capital of British Columbia. All she could expect was non-identifying information, so Allie worked to curb her expectations. Not sure we could consider this synchronistic or serendipitous, but not long after Allie wrote them for all the information they would allow, she received a detailed 4-page response.
It described my birth mother physically. It told me, oh, I need to back up just a little bit. So during that first year, after I was feeling like I really owed my parents, I decided that I was going to go into nursing because I was in fashion design and it felt so useless and so worthless and so superficial. And I really felt like I wanted to make my parents proud of me. So I applied for a nursing program and I got accepted. Then I get the letter. And the letter describes my birth mom, her physical appearance, which is very similar to mine, and that she was 22 and she was in nurses training when she had me. No one else in my family is in the medical profession at all. No one else in my family had even been to university. So the fact that she was in nursing and I had chosen that and was about to start it was absolutely mind-blowing me. It described her parents. Her mom was a teacher who suffered from migraines. Well, I'd had migraines since I was 11 and no one in my family had ever had them. She was artistic and creative and so was I. Her father was a land surveyor and upstanding member of the community sort of thing. And then she described, there was no information about my birth father except she had provided information about him. Sorry, there was no information about his parents, but she had provided information about him that he was a clean-cut, athletic man, you know, who was very kind, like all good stuff, right? So I was holding this in my hand and I felt like I was holding a part of me. Like these people were where I came from. These people were my people, but all I had was this letter. I put it on my head. I went to nursing school. I did my first year of nursing school and I came home at Christmas and it was December 23rd. And I got a phone call at my parents' house. And the woman said, Is this Allie? And I said, yes. And she said, this is so-and-so from Parent Finders. I have a Christmas present for you. And I'd forgotten all about it. And I'm like, oh my God, what? She said, we are 99.9% sure that your birth mother's name is Linda Wagner. Merry Christmas. And I'm like, what? She goes, get a pen and write that down. So I wrote it on, like, tore off the corner of the newspaper that was right by me. And I wrote down Linda Wagner, birth mother. And I said, how do you know? How can you even be sure? And she said, well, we've accessed the birth records from when you were born. And when I got the letter from Vital Stats, they told me the time that I was born. Baby girl born 1:32 a.m. July 15th, 1965 at Grace Hospital, which was different from all where my brothers were born, but I had the time. And so I had given that to Parent Finders and they said, the only baby girl born at 1:32 a.m. on July 15th, 1965 at Grace Hospital was born to a young woman named Linda Wagner. So we're 99.9% sure. So I was like, holy shit. So then I'm in nursing school and I know she was in nursing school. So I start looking at all the old annuals from 1964 and 1966. And I go on this complete obsession of trying to think that maybe she's from the same city as me. And then I got exhausted with that. And I just continued with my schooling. And I took a sociology course and I had an instructor who gave a lecture on the family unit and all the variations of it. And adoption was included in that. So after class, I went up to him. And I said, oh, I just wanted to share my story. I found out just 3 years ago that I was adopted. And just a couple months ago, I found out my birth mother's name. And he said, well, I'd be happy to help you find her if your parents are okay with that. And I said, what, really? And he said, yeah, I know ways that you can track people down. And I said, well, I know my parents know that I'm not looking for new parents. I'm just looking for myself. But yes, I would love that.
Allie's search angel took the form of her sociology professor, with impeccable manners, no less. He called Allie's parents to make sure he wasn't overstepping. So Allie handed over all the information she had on Linda Wagner, including that Linda's father was a land surveyor. All it took for the angel professor was to search for the surname Wagner in the BC registrars of land surveyors. Two showed up. One was deceased, and one was in his 70s at the time.
This is in 1988. So he thought, I think this is who it is. This has got to be Linda Wagner's father, because she wasn't married when she, you know, it was probably her name. So anyway, he said, within a month, he approached me and he said, I have all the information that we need, but I think you should have some counseling before we do this, because this is going to be a huge event in your life and you have no idea how you're going to react. He said, I have a friend who's a psychologist. I'll set you up with her and you can do some counseling and then we'll act on it. I said, well, I need you to be my mediator. I am not going to step into someone's life and announce myself, because she could have kept this secret and no one else around her even knows. So I'm not going to go disrupt someone, but maybe you can find out for me, like when that time comes, if she's wanting contact or what. 6 months go by. It's August 8th, 1988. I'm walking to class and my instructor, Ken, is outside having a smoke. And he says, Allie, come here. I'm just going to give you the information that you need, because, you know, I can't seem to set it up with my friend, the psychologist, and we've been sitting on this information for way too long. And I said, no, I'm sorry. I'm not doing that. You told me that you would be my mediator. There's no way I am making a phone call, a cold call to someone. There's no way. And he started laughing because I had kind of like a little fit about it. And he said, okay, do you want me to make the call? And I said, yes, I want you to make the call. He goes, okay. And I'll see what I can do. And I said, you know, my biggest fear is that I'm a product of rape. That's been my biggest fear since I found out. But my biggest dream is that they got married. He said, I know. We'll find out what we can find out. So again, I put it out of my head. I thought, you know, everything takes so long. I was wrapped up in school. I was wrapped up in my life. And I went to my boyfriend's for dinner, who's my husband now. And we were having dinner and the phone rang. And his dad answered and he said, oh, Allie, it's for you. It's a guy. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And I answer and he goes, it was Ken. He said, hi, Allie, this is Ken. I'm like, oh, hi, Ken. He's all, I just spoke to your birth mother and she sounds exactly like you, but 10 times louder. I'm like, what? He's all, I phoned the number that I had for Gordon Wagner that I'd found. And I asked them if they were the parents of Linda Wagner and that I was trying to get in touch with them. And he said, with her, and he said, yes, she's our daughter. This is her number. They just gave it to this guy on the phone. And he phoned Linda and he said, hi, I'm phoning regarding a young woman who's 23. I'm wondering if you might know who I'm talking about. And she said, excuse me, who's this? And he said, I'm phoning on behalf of your birth daughter. And he said that she just started like screaming joyfully and jumping up and down and crying and saying, oh my God, I've been waiting 23 years for this phone call. I can't believe it. I've been waiting 23 years for this phone call. So he said, and Allie, guess what? And I'm leaning against the counter of my boyfriend's kitchen on the phone. He said, they got married. And my knees buckled and my feet slipped out from under me and my ass hit the floor. And I just cried, took my husband, my boyfriend then, I just went, they got married. And then Ken said, and guess what else? And I'm like, what? He said, they had two sons. They have two sons. You have two sons that are 100% your brothers. So this was all like incredible to take in that moment. And he said, and she wants to meet you right away. And I'm like, I look down, I'm wearing cutoffs and a tie-dye t-shirt. My toenails need to be clipped. I'm like, I can't meet her right now. I need to have a shower. And he's like, no, not right now. Like, you know, in a week. And I'm like, are you kidding me? A week? I'm not waiting a week. I can't wait a week after this. And he's like, okay, I'll phone her back and see when we can meet. She wants to meet you as soon as possible. And he said, where should we meet her? And I was like, was blank. And he's all, I know, there's a muffin break on the corner of Broadway near your school. We could meet her there. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Muffin break? I said, I'm not going to meet her at muffin break. I have to be able to laugh and cry and jump up and down and scream and do everything I need to do, not in a muffin break. And he said, okay, there's a park near Res. I lived in the nurse's residence. We'll meet her there. I'll just confirm. We can see if we can meet her tomorrow at 4. And I said, okay. So anyway, I'm get off the phone. I'm shaking. I'm bawling. I'm crying. I'm telling my boyfriend, and his parents everything that happened. And then all of a sudden I realize my parents, I'm thinking of my parents. And I realized that Ken had gotten Craig's number from my parents. That's the only way he would have found me. So that means my parents are standing there right now going, oh my God, she's just found something out. So Craig drives me as fast as he can, 10 blocks to my mom and dad's house. And I whip out of the car and I go running up the stairs and they open the door and they're standing there bawling. And I just fall into their arms and I just cried and said, they got married. And I said, I don't want new parents. I just want to know about me. And they said, I know, Allie, it's all supposed to be. And I said, but I'm really scared. Like, what if she's not who I think she is? What if she's like a drug addict? What if she needs money? What if she's, you know, and they said, Allie, you're a good person. She's going to be a good person. It's meant to be. So that was August 8th, 1988. So we arranged to meet the next day at 4, which was August 9th. And I, like I'd done all before, I just sort of put it out of my mind. And I went to school, which was work. I was working on the ward. I was in the final rotation of my schooling. And by noon, I thought, holy shit, I'm not going to be able to go to work tomorrow. Like, I know my body and I know my emotions. And no matter how this turns out, I'm going to be probably flat on my back. So I went to my head nurse and I told her, and she goes, oh yeah, this is a big deal. You can take the week off. So anyway, I got off work at 3 and I came home and I was like, you know, should I wear makeup? What am I going to wear? I'm like, okay, not too dressy, not too casual. Like, okay, a skirt and sweater. Okay, mascara. Yeah. Okay, no makeup. It's August. It's fine. And I phone Craig and I go, oh my God, I need to talk to you one last time before my entire life changes. And I said, so he said, it's going to be fine. She's going to be incredible. It's all going to be good. It's meant to be. And I said, okay. Wish me luck. And he's all, you don't need luck, darling. You have destiny. So I hung up the phone. I go outside and Ken's waiting for me. And we start walking the 2 blocks to the park. And I said, you asked her when my birthday was, didn't you? And he stops and he looks at me, goes, no, I didn't ask her when your birthday was. I said, what do you mean you didn't ask her? How do you know she's really the right person? He's all, oh, come off it, Allie. Like, her name's Linda Wagner, da 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 da. She has a 23-year-old daughter that she gave up for adoption. I said, you're just trying to convince yourself. He's all, you're right. And walk fast. We're walking fast. We get up to the park and I look at the park and there's a couple of people in the park and I don't really feel anything. And then I turn and look down the sidewalk and there's a woman standing in the middle of the sidewalk, half a block down. And my knees buckle and I hide behind Ken and I go, I don't know if I can do this. And he puts his hand on my back, like I was like some little fawn learning to walk. He said, of course you can do this. So he pushes me gently in front of him. And that's all I remember of him. I see this woman standing in the middle of the street, middle of the sidewalk, and she's beautiful. She's absolutely radiant. And she's holding a bouquet of flowers. She has a white flowy skirt on and an emerald green blouse. and she's just beaming. And all of a sudden, I feel that space in my chest where I'd felt that gaping wound, like it was a magnet. And I was just getting pulled towards her. And we got closer and closer. And as we got closer, it's like we were in a choreographed dance. We were doing the same things. We were going, oh, and we were like hands on our knees. And like, we were doing the exact same thing. It was so incredible. And finally we reached each other and we were like stared in each other's eyes. And I said, July 15th, 1965. And she said, 1:32 a.m. I said, Grace Hospital. And we're like, yeah. And we had this big hug and this big cheers and this big like love fest. It was incredible. And I got in her car and she drove me to West Van, which was not far from where I was, to meet my brothers and my birth dad. And I had been like, I got in the car and I was like, holy shit, like I haven't thought this far through, like what it would be like to get in her car. And like, my mom didn't even drive. So I was like, I still didn't know who this person was, right? But I felt this real connection and this real bond and this real love. So we drove to West Van, and all of a sudden I'd been over these roads a million times growing up, and all of a sudden everything looked different. I was seeing it all from a completely different perspective, and I had to really focus on like staying present in my body. And we drove up this street and I'm like, I know this street. My cousin lives on this street. And she's all, what's your cousin's name? And I told her, and she goes, oh, her kids play with our kids. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. So anyway, turns out that we had so many areas where our lives completely overlapped, completely. So we arrive in this driveway and there's three people standing in the driveway, two my brothers and my birth dad. And I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I don't want to intrude. I don't want to parachute in. I don't want to make these boys feel like I'm taking their parents or I'm doing anything. And Linda told me that the boys had no idea about me. She had just told them the night before, because my birth dad and her, his name's Gord, never talked about me because it was too painful, and that they had broken up when she got pregnant and met 10 years later and fallen in love and got married and had two boys, but still never talked about me. And so she had to explain it to the boys. I grew up in a family where affection wasn't very, wasn't demonstrated physically. And I got out of the car to meet these boys and they just gave me the hugest heartfelt hugs and looked at me and said, can I call you sis? So I was 10 and 13 years older than them. So it was just incredible. And then, you know, I came up and stood in front of my birth dad and I just said, oh, it's just so good to finally meet you. And he said, you look exactly like Linda when she was 22. Like, you, how could I not love you? And we had a really beautiful moment.
Linda ended up staying for Chinese food, taking in all the similarities between her and her birth mother. They had the same mannerisms, same tone of voice, and the same laugh. The similarities were so striking that Craig was taken aback when he came to pick her up. Everyone saw it.
My little brothers were like basically staring at us with their mouths open, because we were doing the same thing. We were laughing the same way. They're just like, oh my God, like you look so much like mom. I can't believe it. So, but then as I was walking around her house, we owned the same things. I collected heart rocks, big, beautiful river stones and heart rocks. She had this collection of heart rocks around a plant in her dining room. We owned the exact same pottery from a potter on a very small island off the coast of BC. Like, it's not something you can buy in a store. You have to go to Hornby Island, go to the potter and purchase it. And we owned the same mug. It was my favorite mug. So that kind of stuff is just so fascinating. Those types of connections. It's not all been easy. I really had to fight for my own identity once I met her, because I could quickly merge into who she was, right? And I got to say that one of the big things was I never felt like I was 100% belonged in either family. I had a life with the family that I grew up in, but there was always part of me that wasn't there. And I had a life from that point on with my birth family, but there was always part of me that hadn't been there. And it was so beautiful for me when I could have my own children, and I had three daughters, because I knew exactly where I belonged and they knew exactly where they came from. But it's been an absolute blessing. It's been like an incredible story. And I just feel like I always question why it all happened. Like, so many things lined up to make that happen. And yes, it came out in a traumatic way, but you know what? From great pain comes great love. So I feel really blessed. About a week after I met Linda, she went to meet my adoptive parents, who I just call my mom and dad, because they're who raised me. They're who I think of always as my mom and dad.
We asked Allie to describe what it was like when her parents, her adoptive parents, whom she had always referred to as her parents, met Linda, her birth mother, for the first time. It may surprise you to hear Allie's mom's response.
She came walking up that path that I went running down, and my dad opened the door and he said, "There's my girl." My parents were quite a bit older. I was the youngest. My dad was 40 when I came into the family. So he was 62 when I met Linda. And Linda was only 45 or 43 when I met her. So my dad said that he felt like he'd actually gained another me, that he'd gained another daughter. Now, my dad had an easier time with it than my mom, for sure. My mom had a lot of things she had to cope with in her life and not the best methods of working through her own stuff. But she received Linda with open arms. She said, "I just want to thank you for giving her to me." So beautiful and incredible. But for the remainder of the history or the future, I kept those two apart. I kept, because I couldn't be who I was with each of them when they were in the same room. I had a very different relationship with my mom than I did with Linda. And actually with Linda, I felt completely unconditionally loved and accepted. But with my mom, you know, there were sticky points and parts and in our relationship, right? And so I was very mindful not to put myself in that position, but they could be together. There was never any outward bad feelings or bad energy. I met Linda before I graduated from nursing school, before I got married, before I had babies. So Linda and the boys and my birth father, to an extent, because they actually had just separated when I met them, and then they continued on to a divorce, and my relationship was more primarily with Linda and the boys. But they were all a part of those events, which was incredible. And so my little brothers got to be a part of all of that, and great uncles to my daughters and stuff.
Since Allie met her birth parents on the cusp of their divorce, she had no sense of who they were as a couple and was just happy to have any piece of them in her life, whether individually or as a whole family. Allie and Linda became so close, they became major parts of each other's lives, including Allie's children's lives, starting with the birth of her first child. and ultimately helping healing wounds with her adoptive mom as well.
And Linda met us at our apartment when we came home with the baby. She made a beautiful bassinet for this baby girl, and she wanted to be there when the baby came home. And she sat with Emily in the rocker and just cried and rocked her and cried. And I know she was processing all of our past. And, you know, there's just so much healing in those moments, and so much, it's just such a gift. So my mom died in 2013. The last thing she said to me, which I had no idea was going to be the last thing she said to me, because she became unconscious. She was in palliative. I was sitting beside her bed in palliative, and she looked at me and she said, "Just look at you sitting here with me. Just look at you sitting here. What did I ever do to deserve you?" And like, I was like taken back, and I couldn't meet her in that moment because I've had to protect myself emotionally from my mom over my lifetime. And I said, "Well, of course I'm sitting here with you, mom. What else would I be doing? Like, of course I'm here." But I didn't realize what she was saying in the moment. And I didn't realize those would be her last words to me. But, you know, after the fact, when I revisit it, I know what she was saying. You know, she was incredulous of how it all played out. And here I was with her in her last hours. So I really feel like she did a lot of healing, you know, by the end. And it was a real gift. It's a real gift to go back to that moment and actually meet her there, to really go back to that moment and go, "Yeah, mom, wasn't it incredible? Like, weren't we lucky?" So, and then my dad, my dear old dad, after my mom died, he lived 3 years. He died in 2016. And in the 3 years when my mom was gone, he became a part of everything in when I was with Linda and the boys. He came to everything. He could roll with anything. And he absolutely loved Linda, loved her, just absolutely loved her. He started to get sick and weak, and we took him to hospital, and he had complications. And it turned out that, you know, we realized it was going to be his last days. He was 89. And he said, "I'm tired now, and I'm done." And I said, "Okay, Dad, I understand. And I'm going to stay with you until you go, because I want to be here. And I'm not sure if that's going to take a week or 2 days or what, but I'm going to sit here with you." And he never lost consciousness. He just would doze, and he'd wake up with one eye, look at me and squeeze my hand and give me a big smile. And I stayed up with him for 24 hours, and it was 7:30 in the morning. I'd been up for 24 hours and I was beside myself. I didn't realize how painful this was going to be and how tired I was. And I thought, "I don't want him to be alone, but there's only one person I can give him to." And I phoned Linda, my birth mom, and I was bawling my eyes out. And I said, "I can't leave him. I don't want him to be alone. And you're the only person I trust with him." And she said, "I'll be there in a minute." And she came to the hospital, and I said to my dad, I said, "Dad, Linda's going to come sit with you so I can go home and have a nap. Is that okay?" And he said, "Oh, that's a great idea." And so she came in, and he just gave her his big beaming smile, and she gave him a big kiss, and she sat beside him and held his hand. And I went home, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I went, fell asleep in my bed. An hour later, or 2 hours later, my husband woke me up, and he said, Linda just called. Your dad just died. She was holding his hand."
The parental relationship isn't the only thing to change from these discoveries. Sibling relationships are affected strongly.
I grew up with three older brothers. They were 5, 7, and 8 years older than me. And two of them in their teenage years developed severe mental health problems. One of my brothers became psychotic and schizophrenic. My other brother became antisocial personality alcoholic, maybe drug user. But my oldest brother was awesome, and he's who I still have a relationship with and always have. And my other two brothers have died. They died prematurely. But my younger brothers, it's an incredible relationship. There is something different about genetic love than adopted love. And I don't say this to make anything less. There's just something different. So I grew up thinking I was experiencing the love of my brothers and the love of my parents and my family, as everyone does. And then I met my birth family, and it's different. It's genetic. I never had a grandfather, or I did have a grandmother that I grew up with from my mom's side, which I loved deeply and was deeply connected to her. But when Linda and her mom, whose name was Ivy, my grandmother, birth grandmother, and I were together, I swear to God, it was like a womb to womb to womb contact. There was just something very different and powerful about it that I'd never experienced before. And so I feel so blessed that I've got to experience both. And with my brothers, those little boys who are now men, I have such a deep, heartfelt connection with them.
You can't be a guest on our show without talking about identity. It's just one of the main themes of DNA discoveries and sets the course for the rest of your development and relationships.
Actually, meeting Linda was the key to me letting the fullness of myself come forward. So what she offered to me was just such unconditional acceptance that I learned to offer that to myself. And she also, through her, I could see my strengths and my gifts and my, you know, I was able, but also separate from her, I could see my strengths and my gifts. And so it's just really helped me. I guess it's helped me know very clearly who I am and what parts of me are uniquely mine. And I don't find myself in an identity crisis anymore, but I do find myself longing for the love of my mom that I grew up with in a more unconditional way. And I just have to meet her where she is now to get that. That's what I'm working on now. And I'm writing my story, and I'm working on the mother wound and the wounded mother. I feel pretty solid with who I am, though it wavers into this, I wish we had had a more of a unconditional love connection with my mom. It's so interesting because, you know, like everybody wants their mom to love them. Well, I have a mom, but I don't think of her as my mom. I think of her as my birth mom, who loves me unconditionally. But I want that from my mom who raised me. And obviously she got there by the end. That's where I have to meet her. I listen to Brad's story and I just think, whoa, like talk about being hit sideways. And like people are finding this out all over the place, left, right, and center. And there's just so many secrets that have been kept, you know, because of people's shame or people's fear or people's whatever. And it's just, I feel really passionate about people knowing their own story and how wrong and cruel it is to keep that from someone.
Thanks to Allie for sharing her story and reminding us that some good actually comes from this discovery. Allie's story may leave some feeling forlorn since they didn't have the positive outcome with bio family she did. Please remember, you are also a part of the NPE family, and we are always here.
Sex, Lies, and the Truth is written and produced by Jody Klugman-Rabb and Christina Bryan Fitzgibbons.
If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can contact us through our website at www.sexliesandthetruth.com.
If you are a fan of Sex, Lies, and the Truth and want to support us, you can do that through Patreon. Patreon is a really cool platform where fans of shows like ours can pledge a small amount each month, even just a few dollars, to support the show. You can find us there at www.patreon.com/sexliesandthetruth.